Now, I was mentioning a few moments ago we're going to be speaking with the Ombudsman for Children's Office about school admissions and family ties. And joining me is the Policy Officer for the Ombudsman for Children's Office, and that's Ciara Gill. Good afternoon to you, Ciara.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, thank you. I was very interested in this. Last week, obviously, the Ombudsman for Children, Dr. Niall Muldoon, said this, that school admission rules discriminate in favour of past pupils' children, risk locking generations of vulnerable young children into a cycle of disadvantage. That was the warning we got from Niall there, Ciara.
As it stands, 20 oversubscribed schools can reserve 25% of their places for the children or grandchildren of past pupils if they wish to do so. And this just puts certain groups of children at a disadvantage because some children don't have a parent that went to that particular school, but some children have a parent that did not go to secondary school at all. Other children have parents who went to secondary school but abroad. So they're automatically at a disadvantage of getting into these secondary schools. Education is a way of breaking disadvantage.
Mm-hmm. And we're told so often that, you know, education in this country is free, it's inclusive. But as the Ombudsman did say, that we believe, as yourselves at the office, that schools should be fully inclusive and promote equality. So that's clearly not happening if it is that 25% of places.
Now, I suppose, thing already, it's not all schools, and it's only oversubscribed schools. One of the problems is there's no real data on this, so we don't know how many schools use this criteria, and we don't know, I suppose, how many children lose out on school places because of this criteria, which does make it difficult to analyse. But at the same time, in our view, even if one or a handful of children are losing out because of this, then that's too many. And because children just aren't being treated in a fair way if they're being told you can't get a place here because your parent or grandparent didn't go to school here.
Now, my next guest is actually the Chief Executive of the National Parents Council Primary, but they have said that dramatic changes in communities in this country mean that children are growing up in vastly different local communities to that of their parents and grandparents, because there are certain rules nowadays for the school that you may be able to go to in terms of where you live. Is that also an issue, Ciara?
I suppose looking at the... there's a number of different criteria that schools can use, and there's others that they can't use. In a way, none of them are perfect, but at the same time, I suppose some of them are less imperfect than others. So if they're, say, a school catchment area or feeder schools, at least children from different families have some chance of qualifying under those criteria. But if you have a parent that didn't go to secondary school full stop, or if you have a parent who went to secondary school abroad, you can never change that about yourself. So the other criteria, you've some chance of moving into an area, you've a chance of getting a place in the feeder school to the school, but you've no chance of changing your parents' educational background.
Now, the committee, this is the Oireachtas committee that heard these findings last week, did say that there's no evidence yet to show the scale at which numbers are being refused access to their local school on the basis of past pupil provision. Is there a time we'd be able to actually see those numbers, Ciara?
We are not aware of any data being collected. Now, in the last year or two, following the commencement of the Admissions to School Act in 2008, schools are supposed to publish their admissions notice every year, and included in the information that they're to publish is the number of children that applied, the number that were given places, and then kind of the different criteria that were used to give those places out. So schools should be gathering the information. It's just, as it stands, we're not aware that anyone is actually gathering and analysing that data to see, I suppose, what criteria are being used and where the issues are.
So is that something that maybe needs to be put in place in this country?
It's something that would definitely be useful, yes.
Okay. Well, Ciara Gill, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. You are, of course, the policy officer with the Ombudsman for Children's Office there. Last week, Dr. Niall Muldoon spoke about that in front of an Oireachtas committee. And I'd love to hear from you. What's your experience had been like to get, you know, I don't know if it was when you were going to school or get your own kids school places around this county and the situation? Do let us know. 0833 97 97 97. Ireland is not training enough pharmacists, which will result in significant healthcare problems if this is not urgently addressed. Joining me on the line is the president of the Irish Pharmacy Union, that is Dermot Toomey. Good afternoon to you, Dermot.
Good afternoon to you.
Thank you for joining me, because we were speaking this morning about the GP situation in this country. And I have heard from many pharmacists saying that they feel they're almost at times filling the gap at the moment because we're under such pressure when it comes to our general practitioners. But now hearing yourselves at the Irish Pharmacy Union calling on the government to commit to addressing the pharmacist shortage obviously means that gap is not going to be filled.
So I suppose the issue is that, I suppose, like a lot of healthcare professionals, pharmacies and pharmacists are finding that we're not training enough graduates at the moment. And certainly if we want to progress and expand the role of the pharmacist in terms of particularly the vaccination programme, which happened recently, and the COVID vaccination and other services, we actually need more bodies or more pharmacists trained and also in the pharmacies in order to provide those services. And unfortunately, what we're finding is we have three schools of pharmacy in the state, and they're producing about 165 graduates last year. But that isn't sufficient for the needs of the profession and the needs of primary care going forward.
So why isn't the country and third level in Ireland training enough pharmacists?
Well, I think, you know, if we go back maybe when I started 15, 20 years ago, there was just one institution in the state, Trinity College, training pharmacies at that stage. I suppose, you know, over time, more pharmacies have opened. Many pharmacies need a second or a third pharmacist to provide the services. The services that have expanded in that time frame, and we continue to expand further. And I suppose really there would have been a number of graduates coming back from the UK as well. But we're seeing this issue is merged in other countries, such as the UK and Australia, New Zealand, similar issue in terms of not enough graduates. Again, many pharmacists, you know, predominantly would tend to be female, and many people, let's say, would like to maybe work not full time, or they have a family and they're working around their family needs. So there's all of that coming into play.
Now, how does the pandemic affect this whole situation? Because I know you can't, you know, look into the future, but do you expect, I guess, more fallout to happen in the next few months or even years?
Well, I suppose what we would have seen in back 2019, pre-pandemic, that this issue was starting to raise its head. And the IPU, let's say, as an organisation, had set up a forum with other stakeholders to look at it. But unfortunately, then the pandemic took hold, and I suppose a lot of that work was put in abeyance for a couple of years. I suppose anecdotally on the ground, you know, many of the pharmacists you would have spoken to and colleagues of mine are finding it very difficult to get time off to attend family situations, to go on holidays or that sort of thing. And while as an organisation, we certainly want to be progressing and expanding the role of pharmacy, in order to do that properly, we feel that there needs to be a greater number of pharmacists trained.
Locuming is very common in the sector, isn't it, Dermot?
It is indeed. And look, it's a very good...
And just explain that, I guess, to our listeners first off.
Yeah, sorry. Locuming is where basically a person might do a day or a number of days in a particular pharmacy and then move to another pharmacy. Again, it suits people who maybe are trying to juggle the work-life balance with family and that. And but having said that, and it's a very important part of the sector to have locums to be able to do it, I suppose what we're looking for is, in order to train more graduates, to have more people to, I suppose, work more full-time, because locuming is quite attractive for many ways, also financially, but really pharmacies can't run themselves just with locums. You know, you need a permanent staff as well, and that's what we're looking for.
And Dermot, have you at the union any idea where you would like to see a new pharmacy school situated in the country?
No, I mean, to be fair, we've communicated with the Minister for Health and Minister for Education, and, you know, we'd like to progress that further in terms of anything to do with location or anything like that. We would be agnostic on it. All we're looking for really is to reflect, I suppose, what the reality on the ground is, which is that I think last year we trained 165 pharmacists. That's 2.4% of the profession, and that wouldn't be sufficient in order to maintain current levels, not to mind, future expansion of the role. And as I said to you, many of our colleagues are finding, particularly in the summer period, that it's almost impossible to get locums or to take holidays. And I suppose it's a sector that while we're doing a lot of good, positive work in terms of COVID vaccination, etc., in order to continue that work and to expand it into the future, we need the proper resources for that.
So to discuss just the specifics that have been spoken about with the Health Department and the Minister for Health in particular, from yourselves, what have they been? Just the basics, a new pharmacy school is needed, and, mentioning the stats there, like the 2.4% of the profession actually being trained in the past year.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like, we would have also have discussions with the Pharmaceutical Society in terms of, speeding up the process where people come in from a third country. So there are graduates that would come in from other countries such as South Africa or New Zealand or Australia. But the process in order to get them registered is quite long. And in certain circumstances, it's actually taken up to 3 years, which really isn't sustainable, you know. If you wanted to say you think you're going to maybe go to Australia next year and you find out that it's going to be another 2 years before you can even get to the country, you might just decide to go somewhere else. So, look, I mean, I think it's a multifaceted approach we're looking at. I think an extra school of pharmacy would certainly be a step in the right direction, but also some work around how we can get graduates from other countries to come in if they're interested in working in Ireland.
OK, well, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. That is the president of the Irish Pharmacy Union, and it is Dermot Toomey there on the impending crisis, the union is saying, in terms of the pharmacy sector. And obviously, we always knew how important our pharmacists were. But again, the pandemic, the past 24 months, 23 months, whatever it has been now, has only highlighted that. And thank you, Dermot, for joining me this afternoon. Joining me on the line now is Joanne Callaghan. She is a sleep expert. And we're going to be discussing why we need to make sleep a priority and how it affects our bodies. Good afternoon, Joanne.
Hi, Ciara. How are you today?
I am good. Thank you. We were speaking a little earlier, and I have to say, I'm not somebody who suffers when it comes to sleep. I absolutely love sleeping. I can nap. I could sleep anywhere. And I really feel for people who can't do that, Joanne. It must be so difficult, suffering from insomnia, etc. But we need, all of us, all humans, we need to make it a priority because it affects our immune system. And that's something that I think a lot of people have done more research into since the pandemic was declared.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Sleep is just so vital for our overall health, for everything physical, our emotional health, our mental health, spiritual health, everything. And there's not one cell in our body that does not benefit from a good night of sleep. And you mentioned the immune system, and it has not really been appreciated before on the level how profound a good night of sleep can impact the health of our immune system. And, you know, lots of people are taking the vaccines and all this sort of thing. But you know what? A good night of sleep can be the one thing that can really help to boost and keep that immune system really, really strong. And, you know, at nighttime when we're asleep, and there's a process where we have these killer cells, and these killer cells actually kill viral cells, viral entities in our body, if you like. And viruses are really, really sneaky because they hide in our cells. That's why viral infections are so hard to detect and so hard to get rid of or eliminate, if you like. And one of the processes when we're sleeping, when we're in a deep phase of sleep, we produce these natural killer cells, which enable us to fight any kind of viral infection. So a lot of people are not actually aware of that process during the nighttime when we're in a deep phase of sleep. So that's one of the major significant impacts of sleep.
Yeah, I think we all know times that we've been ill, even pre-pandemic, if you are somebody who got COVID even before that, that you have a good night's sleep and you do feel so much better. Even if you're still a bit ill, you do feel so much better. But for example, Joanne, I had a late night over the weekend, and I notice after having late nights, I'm always so much hungrier. Always. Even if there's no, you know, sometimes people say it's alcohol related. Even if there's no alcohol related, I'm always so much hungrier. Like, I want everything I could possibly get my hands on. And appetite is something that's definitely affected by our sleep.
It is, because if you think about it, if you have not slept well the night before, even one night, and you're so right, because our body does not have enough energy because we haven't slept well. So what does the body do? The body is so intelligent. The body actually makes us hungry. So we have these two hormones, ghrelin and leptin, and we have more of this ghrelin, which makes us hungry. And it does this on purpose because we get energy from our food. So if we're tired, we need more energy. So what better place to get it than food? But not only do we we're tired and we eat more, we're eating the wrong types of food, because again, the body is very intelligent and it's looking for a quick fix of glucose. So what type of foods can we eat to get a quick release of glucose? So the carbohydrates, the sweets, the cakes, the biscuits. So this is why we tend to eat more, but also more the wrong types of food, and you know, contributes to gaining weight as well. So it's a vicious cycle.
Now, something I thought was really interesting, I saw in an article today, you can't bank sleep, but you can fall into debt. I think that's a good way of looking at the situation and keeping in mind that you need to make sure that you're always staying on top of it. But it's something that I think people sacrifice an awful lot when they feel like they have very busy lives. Sleep is one of the first things that is sacrificed.
Yeah, absolutely. And when we're younger, we tend to think that our bodies can just go, you know, and a lot of people brag, and like a badge of honor, they only need 5 hours of sleep or whatever. But, you know, as we age, if you like, we tend to lose a lot of our hormones and the ability for everything seems to break down. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. We can still live a life with longevity and a good quality of life. And that's what this is all about. So we really need to be mindful of our body and give our body nutrition, in food, but I also mean in terms of exercise and good sleep, everything to enable our body to have that resilience and age gracefully. So this is really, really important.
Well, it's always good to hear that we need to sleep more, because I absolutely love doing it. I'm definitely going to take your advice, Joanne Callaghan, sleep expert from Athy. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon, and happy Valentine's Day to you.
And you too.
Thank you. We'll talk to you again soon, Joanne.